2015 marks the 50th anniversary of the project known as the Grateful Dead. Hi, I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is A Novel Idea. No Simple Highway, A Cultural History of the Grateful Dead, is Peter Richardson's colorful story of the band, of the times, of the community, and the music of the Grateful Dead. Please stay with us. It's Peter Richardson for the hour. It's the Grateful Dead, and it's a novel idea. Peter Richardson is the author of A Bomb in Every Issue, How the Short, Unruly Life of Ramparts Magazine Changed America, and American Prophet, The Life and Work of Kerry McWilliams. He is the book review editor at the National Memo and teaches American culture at San Francisco State University. His most recent book, coinciding with the 50th anniversary of the Grateful Dead, is the highly informative and entertaining No Simple Highway, A Cultural History of the Grateful Dead. Whether you're a deadhead or not, you'll enjoy the culture and history of the Northern California music scene and the social currents that the Dead rode. Let's listen to our conversation. Peter Richardson, welcome to Sonoma County.
Thank you very much for having me.
We're here to talk about your just released book, A Cultural History of the Grateful Dead, No Simple Highway. And the book has a somewhat academic bent, but a little bit on the hip side there. And so it makes it a fun read from both perspectives. And throughout the book, you refer to the Grateful Dead as a project more so than a band. I wondered if you could talk about that, about the project of the Grateful Dead, and does it continue today?
Yes, I think it does. I'm glad you picked up on that because it's probably a word that I use quite a bit when talking about the Grateful Dead, partly because a lot of people dismiss the band because they don't care for the music. And I've always said you don't have to like the music to love their story. And I go way out of my way, perhaps too far out of my way, to make sure that people realize that for all of their studied nonchalance, the Dead had a project, that it was remarkably stable over time, that the values underneath the project and that propelled the project were also remarkably stable. The organization changed a lot. The music changed a lot. But there was this kind of arc over their 30-year trip together as a band. And also, it wasn't just about music. It was also about community. It was also about what they called creating the hip economy. And it was also about helping their friends. And it was also about interacting with other artists, poster artists and photographers. And so it had a lot of different aspects and kind of tendrils, not all of which were exhausted by the music. So even for people who don't like the music or don't like some of the music, I think there's still a fascinating story here and a remarkably successful project that lasted for almost three decades, which is maybe the most remarkable part.
In my notes when I was reading through the book, I came across a phrase, ecstasy, mobility, and community. And then, I realized that's exactly how you structured the book and that was the section headings. What drove you to organize the book thematically that way?
Well, by now, and this is not the first book on the Grateful Dead, and a lot of readers have read a lot of them. And so from the outset here, I was thinking, what can I add to this short shelf of books that's already out there, most of which are memoirs? There are some histories. There's a couple of biographies of Jerry Garcia. And I thought, you know, I really need to make sure that I'm not just rehearsing things that other people have said, that I'm adding something to our understanding of the Grateful Dead. And one of the things I thought I could do is move a little bit more toward a kind of interpretive history of the dead. Like, what was it about their music and their project that allowed them to be so successful for so long? And I don't think you can always kind of back that out of the books that are already out there. I mean, you can sort of connect the dots, but I wanted to put that front and center just by asking the very simple question, why? You know, why this band and not some of their colleagues or peers? Jefferson Airplane sold more records. Creedence Clearwater Revival, you know, sold more records and more popular in many ways. But those bands tended to burn out or fade away. And the dead just kept rumbling on. And so I wanted to make sure that I started with that basic question of why. And then what that forced me to do was come up with a few explanatory ideas. Like, what was it exactly that distinguished their project from the projects of these other bands? And I thought that those three things, ecstasy, that is the urge for transcendence, for that experience of total rapture, was a big part of it. Also mobility. And what by that I just mean that they took a necessity, which is that they had to tour a lot because they decided to remain in the San Francisco Bay Area and they didn't sell enough records to just live off their royalties, or rather, they didn't sell enough records to support the scene that they wanted to support, employ the people they wanted to employ, and do what they wanted to do musically. So they virtually had to become a touring band, but they embraced that. It not only became part of their operation, it also became part of their mythology. They tapped into that American fascination with the open road, which they picked up from the Beats. They were all big Jack Kerouac fans. And so going out on the road became this kind of signature for them. And that's what I meant by the mobility part. And then the third thing is community. And I think that probably is the most important piece of the puzzle, that from the very outset, they were always fostering community, and that was an important part of their project. And it became an important part of that project's durability too, because there were some creatively slack periods in there. There were periods when the albums weren't selling very well. There were periods when they had some financial setbacks, embezzlement, for example, and other kinds of problems with their business. But they always had their tribe. And as long as they had that community, they could keep touring and kind of keep moving ahead. And that also let them do some experiments musically. You know, they never wanted to repeat themselves. They were very committed to improvisation. But they also were always looking for new things to do musically as well. They never turned into a kind of self-imitation or a nostalgia act, even though they were written off as a nostalgia act as early as the late 1970s. So I thought that those three things, there are more, of course, but I thought that those three things did a lot of explaining when it comes to that basic question of why the dead were that successful for so long.
It's not a biography, though there's biographical material in it. And I couldn't help but to see that Jerry Garcia was the epicenter of this ethos. And he certainly had early influences, and then with the band, their early involvement with Ken Kesey, for instance. What do you think drove him or set him in this direction of that this tribe, this larger community of fans seemed to focus on what radiated from him?
No, I think you're exactly right. I mean, Robert Hunter at one point, much later, said, the whole Grateful Dead organization is a reflection of Jerry Garcia's mind. He was a very reluctant leader, but I think everybody looked to him, not only musically, but also organizationally when they had a big decision to make. I mean, he didn't like conflict and he didn't really want to be an active leader. He thought it was ludicrous, for example, that Mick Jagger made all the important decisions for the Rolling Stones. He could barely believe that. It seemed so unnatural to him. And the Dead ran their scene pretty democratically, really. They shared their earnings more or less equally. They made decisions together. The president of the corporation was one of their crew members. It wasn't very hierarchical or anything like that. They really walked the walk when it came to those kind of 60s kind of tribal and, you know, slightly countercultural values. But to get to your question, Suzanne, which is a really good one, like what was it about Jerry Garcia and his early experience? Now, they were nothing if not collaborative, so you don't want to overestimate Jerry Garcia's contribution. But I spend a good bit of the book, especially early on, trying to figure out what was happening with Jerry Garcia. And I traced it back, actually, many of his interests and some of these kind of values to this 12-month period between his 15th and 16th birthdays, where four important things happened. The first thing is that he received an electric guitar for his birthday. He actually received an accordion and then traded it in for a Dan Electro guitar. He was thrilled with that, so that was very important. The second thing is that he discovered marijuana. Now, his parents owned a bar. He was very familiar with the bar scene. It was more kind of a saloon, really. They opened it only 4 years after the repeal of Prohibition. It was on Rincon Hill in San Francisco, not far from the Embarcadero. It was mostly sailors, seamen, warehousemen. It was, you know, very freewheeling environment where his parents owned this bar. Of course, his father was a professional musician as well. He didn't like alcohol. I mean, he discovers marijuana when he's 15 years old. He wasn't very interested in school, but he was very interested in illustration and art. And he signed up for art classes like weekends and summers and things like that at what's now the San Francisco Art Institute. And that turned out to be incredibly important because he not only learned how to make art from his teachers there, but he also learned from Wally Hedrick, who was really his chief mentor, who was married to Jada Feo. I mean, they were making some very important art. They weren't getting a lot of credit at the time, but they were living this kind of really interesting, enticing, bohemian life that I think would have made a big impression on anybody, including Jerry Garcia, who was kind of looking for more. So running into the San Francisco Art Institute and the way they lived was a big lesson for Jerry Garcia. And it was through Wally Hedrick that he found out about Jack Kerouac and the Beats. And those, you know, that novel was just coming out at the time. And, of course, Jerry Garcia and the Grateful Dead were not the only ones that were really impressed by what Jack Kerouac was doing at the time. But Kerouac was out in San Francisco at that time as well. So then this kind of national media spotlight was on San Francisco and the San Francisco art scene. And so I think that those four things were really important in persuading Jerry Garcia to pursue this path that he took. I mean, he never really went back to straight life. He never finished high school. He sort of washed out of the army very quickly. He really just wanted to make music. And, you know, this bohemian scene that surrounded the mid-century San Francisco art scene, I think, turned out to be really important. And he even said that. I mean, I'm not inferring anything here. You have to dig a little bit. He didn't talk about it a lot. He wasn't asked about it that often. But he was very clear about the debt that he owed to those instructors that he had over there, not only for teaching him how to make art, but in teaching him how to live like an artist.
That whole time period, especially I'd say those 10 or 15 years between, say, 1965 and 1980, were such a transitional period. And it's really kind of amazing to think of all of these musicians having this very fluid and relationship with each other and influencing each other. And it didn't seem to be in a competitive way either. And I really can't imagine that sort of intimacy and cross-fertilization happening today. Mm. And it almost seems that as soon as the energy or vibrancy was discovered or announced or commodified, really, that they had to leave that scene and move someplace else.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, I think the initial vibrancy, again, I think can be traced back to the models that they had before them. I mean, in the 1950s, for example, these painters and sculptors, also very small but vibrant, kind of insular, and very much do-it-yourself. They didn't have those institutions that could support them that they might have had in Los Angeles or New York City or even Nashville or Chicago. You know, they didn't have a developed scene there. They didn't have, you know, outside resources to compete for. And so they helped each other. And that was one of the hallmarks, I think, of the mid-60s music scene, and not just the music, but the art scene more generally, because of the psychedelic poster artists and the photographers and all the other artists that were drawn to this scene were treated the same way. You know, there was a lot of enthusiasm for the kinds of, you know, things that were coming out of the scene, and its incredible fertility, really striking. But you're exactly right. I mean, as soon as the labels discovered it, and they discovered Jefferson Airplane first, Garcia worked on Surrealistic Pillow, and it was sort of through that nexus that Warner Brothers Records discovered, which didn't have anything going in rock and roll at the time, really not very much in music, period, but they figured they wanted to get in on it. And that began to change the scene a little bit. And also the Summer of Love and the way the Summer of Love turned out in 1967, the whole scene just kind of collapsed under its own weight. I think the art scene got a little bit swamped by this influx of young people that the city was not really set up to support. And the scene, you know, started turning a little rancid. And the Dead got out of there pretty quickly. I mean, they were in Marin County by 1968.
And in that going to Marin County, it embodied a whole nother thing of kind of the mobility or getting back to the land or having a lot of space to inspire.
Yeah, that the really back to the land movement, which was peaking during that time, is another important backdrop, I think, for the Dead's project. Not just for the way they were living. You know, they did move to Marin and kind of spread out. Mickey Hart had a ranch. David Crosby had a ranch also in Nevada. They began spending more time with David Crosby and Stephen Stills. And, you know, just making music together. And Garcia also played on their debut album. He plays that opening steel guitar riff, pedal steel riff for Teach Your Children. It was the same kind of sharing and cross-fertilization. But this time, the Dead decided to let their music reflect that, which wasn't that much of a stretch because most of them had been very wrapped up in the folk revival scene before they became an electric blues band. After the British invasion, which they were very impressed by, so they had all these folk and kind of country chops that they were working on. Jerry Garcia got a pedal steel guitar somewhere in 1967, I think, and he became very enamored of it and was kind of taught himself how to play it. And pretty soon their music was reflecting that. And they saw the success of Crosby, Stills, and Nash debut album, which was huge, not just commercially, but critically acclaimed album. And they thought, well, you know, we could probably do that. And they did. They did something very much like that with the harmonies and the acoustic guitars and very folksy, you know, and also the iconography on the album art. It was very much in keeping with the Back to the Land movement, which was kind of peaking during that time. And I would say that kind of the ultimate expression of that was really Woodstock. And you think of that Joni Mitchell lyric that, you know, we got to get back to the garden. And that became really the first commercial success that the Grateful Dead had, Working Man's Dead and American Beauty. And that gave them something to tour behind. I mean, they hadn't really been doing national tours before that. And when Warner Brothers heard Uncle John's Band, I mean, the first time they heard it, they could hear the cash registers ringing. You know, they knew that this was their going to be the first album that the Dead did that actually moved some units, and they were very excited. So that really sets them up. They moved on musically, as they always did. But that kind of set up this kind of touring machine that they developed in the 1970s, and that kind of rumbled on into the 80s and 90s, into what some people call the mega Dead period, where they started to play stadiums and things like that. And, you know, by 1991, they're the highest grossing touring band in North America. So a lot of ups and downs in between.
Yeah, a lot of ups and downs in between. And that is so much tied in with the way they handled business, too. And it was kind of ironic that when they seemed to have that moniker of being washed up or a throwback, or is when they started actually getting more traction and making more money. Also, for their live venues, they invested a lot of money in their sound systems. And I found that kind of interesting, that to them it wasn't about decibels. It was about fidelity.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. Now, that was the vision, really, of, I mean, they were all invested in it and dedicated to it. But in many ways, that was the vision of Owsley Stanley, who was one of their early patrons. By that time, Stanley had been making a fair amount of money selling LSD. When he first started, it was actually legal. But he was a maniac about precision and a big gearhead. They all were, you know, so getting the instruments right and getting the sound system right was very important to them, because they cared about the concert experience. They cared about the audience's experience, and they really saw themselves primarily as live performers. I don't think they ever thought of themselves as studio musicians. And they usually expressed disappointment with their studio albums. They thought what they were mostly about were these live performances, and especially the improvisation, because when that worked, it was really fantastic. So by investing in that sound equipment, they were not only enhancing this experience of the people who came, which was another way of kind of including them and supporting the community, but it also engendered another distinctive part of their operation and community, and that is the activity of taping. So with that fidelity, people realized, gosh, we could tape these things and listen to them. And of course, the taping technology was changing very rapidly as well, and it was being miniaturized so that it wasn't very hard to get a pretty good recording device into the concert and tape these shows. And that's exactly what happened. And they made a few token efforts early to kind of shut that down. But for the most part, they were pretty hands-off about it. And then that began, that turned out to be one of the smartest things they ever did operationally, insofar as it allowed people who shared an interest in the Grateful Dead to stay connected with each other and use these tapes as a kind of alternative form of currency in between shows. And so there was trading. It was frowned upon to sell the tapes, but it was okay to trade. And of course, duplication. And pretty soon, you know, that they had more music in circulation. I mean, you know, studio albums, live albums, but also these concert tapes than almost anyone else. And that was supposed to be, that went against the conventional wisdom of the music business, because tapes were supposed to be a close substitute for the studio albums and live albums. That turned out not to be true. It turned out in the Dead's case that it grew the community and consolidated the community, which was a good move for them. And, you know, so by breaking the rules, sometimes they actually found new and even better ways to run their operation.
Almost counterintuitive, mm-hmm. but it really worked for them. And that whole, it underscores the whole thing of their, this community that really had a life of its own and still does.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I'm sure you've been following, or a lot of people have been following this announcement of the Soldier Field shows and the incredible response and the demand for these tickets. They're only doing three shows in Chicago. Of course, it doesn't surprise anybody in the community who have been talking about such things and following them closely, and the amount of kind of dead trivia that you can see in this community is almost a little scary, especially if you're trying to write about the dead, because I mean some of the control and command that people have over the details of the Grateful Dead's concerts especially is unbelievable.
Yes, of knowing which concert date was the best performance and, yeah. and that sort of thing.
Right.
And I know a little bit about a friend of mine is put in for tickets, mm-hmm, and it mm-hmm. was a real process. But in your book, it said that I guess the Dead have a history of giving preference maybe to people who were on their mailing list, got right. first cut of the tickets. And it's almost a similar process with these Chicago shows coming up this summer.
Yes, very similar. Yes. And that started in the 80s under Danny Rifkin. So Danny Rifkin, who actually was running a boarding house in the 1960s in the Haight, which turned out to be 710 Ashbury, where they all lived together. Most of them lived together for a short time, only about a year and a half. But it was a kind of, it's a time that a lot of people know about. I mean, they were in Marin for more than 30 years. They were only in San Francisco for about a year and a half, but people still think of them as a San Francisco band. But Danny Rifkin turns out to be kind of an important character in a lot of these decisions. He was a manager for a while. He worked as a roadie for a while. He took some time off. He came back. But he worked as the manager in the 1980s, and he was the one who thought, let's figure out a different way to sell tickets. He was also, around the same time, he was the one who argued forcefully that they should not only allow taping, but they should formally permit it. And so he was an important part of that decision, too. So some of these figures, they never are on stage, but they end up being very important parts of the Grateful Dead's operation. And that ticketing process made it so that, I think Dennis McNally told me that for the next 15 years or so, 10 or 12 years, they only had a few shows that didn't sell out. And a lot of that was because people were very good about ordering their tickets through the mail. They didn't really want to stand in line all night. As they got older, especially, it wasn't something that they wanted to do every single time. And it was, as you say, it was another way for the Dead to reward their loyal listeners over the years. That didn't always work. I mean, a lot of those loyal listeners were very averse to the fact that they began to play these larger stadiums, which had its own logic in a way. And even the band members were kind of conflicted about it, especially the band members. But it was the way the cookie crumbled and the way that they kind of kept everything going forward. But it did compromise one of their basic ideals, which was that experience of rapture through music, which is kind of hard to achieve in a stadium setting compared to some of the smaller venues they like to play.
I'm talking with Peter Richardson on his recent book, No Simple Highway, A Cultural History of the Grateful Dead. You're listening to KRCB's A Novel Idea. I'm Suzanne Lang. Let's take a short break. Stay with us.
Bye.
The Grateful Dead, and Touch of Grey. Let's get back to my conversation with Peter Richardson and No Simple Highway, A Cultural History of the Grateful Dead.
In the book, there are many side characters that we may not be highly familiar with. Stuart Brand, who notably published the Whole Earth Catalog, and Robert Hunter, who collaborated as a lyricist. But I was really interested in the influence of Ralph J. Gleason, mm-hmm. who some of our listeners might not know who he was, but he was an early promoter of the Grateful Dead, and he seemed to really get them. And he seemed to really get them in context of music and connecting them to a tradition of jazz. And so can you maybe tell our listeners who Ralph J. Gleason mm-hmm. is, to frame that, and about how he served to promote them?
I'm so glad you picked up on that. I think Ralph Gleason is somebody that really more people should know about. And I think there will be some more work coming out on Ralph J. Gleason. He was from New York, or he came from back east. He went to Columbia University. He was very interested in jazz. He wrote for Downbeat magazine for a long time. He came out to San Francisco, still covering jazz mostly, but he got more interested in, you know, Bob Dylan and the Beatles, and sort of opened up his game a little bit. And then he listened to what was happening in San Francisco with, he was a huge Lenny Bruce fan also. He wrote all the liner notes for comedian Lenny Bruce's albums. And Jerry Garcia also had an interesting connection with Lenny Bruce, who was one of these 1950s figures that San Francisco sort of became known for, you know, along with the Beats, of sort of pushing back some frontiers, in this case, in terms of stand-up comedy, very political and very edgy kind of comedy. So he was very broad and a very versatile writer. He was a music critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. He also was a contributing editor to Ramparts magazine, which was at the time very well-known political muckraker. He did not like Ramparts' coverage of the hippie scene, however, in the run-up to the Summer of Love. In fact, he was furious by the way the magazine covered the Spring of Love, I guess you would say. And he resigned from the magazine at that point. And he turned his attention, he and a protege decided to start another magazine, which was Rolling Stone magazine. And they actually mocked up the first couple of issues in the Ramparts office. So, you know, he was both a very astute writer. He was very politically aware. He had a huge network, not only in the arts, but also in politics, and especially on the left. He co-founded Rolling Stone, as I said. He was also one of the principals in getting the Monterey Pop Festival started. He not only covered music, but he sort of helped it happen. And he was a very important champion for San Francisco musicians, most notably, but not exclusively, the Grateful Dead and Jefferson Airplane. He wrote a book about that scene that came out in the mid to late 60s. It was very astute, very perceptive. And what's interesting about reading Ralph J. Gleason now is you go back, it really holds up well. You know, there's nothing in there that feels dated or antique or anything you can kind of condescend to from this position, you know, some years later looking back, just like, well, you know, that's what people thought at that time or something like that. He was super hip. He lived in Berkeley, and so he was very aware of what was going on the east side of the Bay as well. And, you know, I just found him to be one of those characters where when you go to him, you know, he can open up the story in a lot of interesting ways. And so what I was trying to get away from was characters that you introduce and they say one thing and then they disappear, you know, which makes it tough to read. So I was looking for characters like that. Stuart Brand, as you mentioned, was another one. Characters who kind of move the story along at different points or at multiple levels. And Ralph J. Gleason was definitely one of those people.
And the quote you have from him in the book, astute is the term that came to mind. They seemed as if they were the observations he was making. They almost seem like the observations we might make from a distance or from over time, but that he had them in the moment, I thought was incredible.
Just one more thing on Ralph J. Gleason. I just finished reading, I'm writing a review actually of a biography of Richard Pryor called Becoming Richard Pryor. It turns out that Richard Pryor sort of learned his comedy trade in Greenwich Village, and then he migrated to Los Angeles, and then he flopped badly in Las Vegas. And at that point, it was 1971, he gave it all up. He came to San Francisco, Berkeley, actually, for the first time, with Alan Farley, who was working for KPFA at the time, and then went on to work at KLW. And Richard Pryor was living in this apartment in Berkeley where the tear gas had been flying like a week before. And he set up Richard Pryor with some radio work at KPFA, gave him a program. I think they only taped four shows. And Richard Pryor started doing a kind of new form of stand-up. He sort of reinvented himself in Berkeley in 1971 and became the Richard Pryor that we know now. That's why the book is called Becoming Richard Pryor. But Ralph Gleason noticed him very early on and said, "This is the most important comedian working the nightclub circuit right now in the Bay Area." So he just had this incredible range and this incredible feeling for talent and spotting it and nurturing it and developing it. And I didn't know anything about the Richard Pryor connection until I had read this book. But, you know, when you put that together with the support that he gave to the Dead and Rolling Stone and the Monterey Pop Festival and everything else, really extraordinary figure.
And you just mentioned KPFA, which you do mention occasionally in the book, but I mean, I knew it had a deep history, but I didn't realize the significance of KPFA as a venue for a lot of these artists.
Exactly. So KPFA was important at a couple different points. One is that Phil Lesh worked there as a board engineer, you know, board guy, and on the Midnight Special, which was the I think a folk music hour. That was a weekly program, and he invited Jerry Garcia on, and they actually showcased Jerry Garcia before anybody knew who these guys were. That's when he was still playing bluegrass and folk music, and I think it was called An Evening with Jerry Garcia, the Long Black Veil, which was a country song, popular country song that had come out in 1959. That sounds older, actually, but was a very successful song. So that was one thing. But they also, KPFA also did a lot of work with these kind of avant-garde musicians, and they shared some studio space in San Francisco with the San Francisco Tape Music Center. And, you know, so they were doing a lot of things that I don't associate with the radio station now so much. But at several different points, you can see that KPFA, which was so innovative and pioneering, I mean, they were the first listener-supported public radio station in the country, starting in 1949. They're still listener-supported, you know, no corporate underwriting or anything like that, certainly no commercials. So, you know, it was one of those things. The Bay Area had this kind of rich cultural stew that allowed new talent to come along and gave them a little bit of space to develop that talent. And then I think the Dead went on to kind of expand that space. And when they started their touring, in a way, they took some of these countercultural values that they had inherited from the Beats and from Ken Kesey. But only so many people can get into Jack Kerouac's car or Ken Kesey's bus. I mean, if you really want to expand the social space for the transmission spread of these countercultural values, you really needed something like the Grateful Dead, who just crisscrossed the country, you know, and inviting people to come in and kind of complete these performances. And that's what I think Nick Merriweather, who's the Grateful Dead archivist at UC Santa Cruz, meant when he said that the Dead democratized Bohemia. I mean, they really brought it to your town and let you experience it directly. And, you know, if you lived in San Francisco or Berkeley or anywhere in the San Francisco Bay Area, you could see these things on your own if you were so inclined. But if you're living in some of these other places that the dead went to, I mean, this was the show, right? This was like the circus coming to town. And Jerry Garcia actually said it was very much, I mean, becoming a deadhead was a little bit like running away with the circus at that time. And I think that's partly what he meant.
And your book is a cultural history, and you do include asides, I'll call them, that frame the times and deepen our understanding in a way. And I wanted to ask you about your inclusion of some of these things, like the Jim Jones. I felt your, I don't know how many pages, maybe mm-hmm. 4 pages or 5 pages, I don't know, that you devote to Jim Jones, but I felt in those pages I learned more than I knew or know, and you really opened that up in a way, and just even you're talking about the Symbionese Liberation Army and that sort of thing. So how did you gauge what to include there?
Great question, man. That really goes right to the heart of this project. And I worried that maybe there was a little too much on that. I would really like to talk about that and be very clear about it. Jim Jones had nothing to do with the Grateful Dead, obviously, directly. The reason I decided to tell the story of Jim Jones and People's Temple and ultimately Jonestown is because by focusing on the themes that I was talking about, ecstasy, mobility, and community, I felt it was important to compare and contrast the Dead's version of that project to other ones that were happening around them. And, you know, when you talk about Jim Jones and the appeal that it had, that People's Temple had, people felt that ecstasy when they went to hear Jim Jones and went to church at People's Temple, and they had community. You know, and there were all these echoes, even a little bit of the whole Back to the Land thing, like this thing that they were building in Guyana. You know, we're going to raise our own food, and we're, you know, this is going to be this kind of idyllic, even pastoral kind of experience that we're going to have. And we're just going to shed all of this stuff that is messing us up here in, you know, in our earthly existence here in the San Francisco Bay Area. So I introduced that story partly to contrast it with the way the Dead ran their operation. I mean, and, you know, there are some points of contact where you can see some broad similarities, but then when you drill down a little bit, you see how different those things were. Now, I wasn't sort of trying to set up a straw man, like, you know, hey, the Dead were not, you know, Jonestown. But it's important, I think, to note that in the late 1970s, this is the period when music critics were first starting to describe the Deadhead community as a cult. And that word had a very specific and very powerful charge in the late 70s, partly because of Jonestown and partly because of the Moonies, who were getting their first publicity, in the big national media at that time. So it seemed important to me to show that that the Dead were sort of getting tarred, maybe very lightly, with that brush. And that, in fact, ultimately, the projects were quite different. I mean, that just for example, I mean, the amount of control that the Dead tried to exert over their community, very light-handed. I mean, Jerry Garcia always said, the Deadheads invented themselves, you know, and, you know, they created some space for it, but that was not part of the Grateful Dead's. They weren't running this from headquarters. You know, they encouraged it a little bit at the beginning by inventing the term Deadhead and inviting people to write in and tell them, hey, what's going on with you? You know, tell us what you're doing, where you are, and so on. And people responded. And those letters are down at the UC Santa Cruz archive. They're fascinating. You know, so they really were fostering that kind of community, but they had no interest in controlling people's personal lives in the way that Jim Jones did, for example. So, you know, you don't want to overdo the parallels, but there were some. And then the differences, I think, were even more important.
I loved the way also in the book you, well, Jerry Garcia was notoriously not pushing political agendas and didn't like to be associated with that sort of thing. But you contrast Jerry Garcia and Ronald Reagan in a way who both maybe could be seen as appropriating the Western mythology. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I thought that was kind of fun that you included that in the book.
Yeah, the Western part of it. I mean, the data had moved on from kind of their high cowboy period. But it was when Reagan was governor in Sacramento, the first two terms, where the Dead had their first commercial success, really. I mean, in many ways, the Dead were never more popular than when Reagan was in power, first in Sacramento and then in the White House when they did The Touch of Grey, you know, and they had their first top 10 single. But even back during the two terms of when Reagan was governor of California, you know, Reagan was going after hippies. There's no doubt about it. I mean, he was definitely gaining politically from his quips about hippies and also political activists and youth culture, really, in general. And he showed other politicians, this is costless. You know, this isn't going to cost you anything to go after youth culture. It's not going to cost you any votes. It'll probably get you some votes. I mean, you know, so people were watching. And you're right. The Dead were very circumspect about making any kind of political pronouncements. That really wasn't part of their repertoire. They certainly had, you know, political commitments that were revealed by their philanthropy, for example. You could figure out what their politics were just by what they supported with their own money and the money that they helped raise. And I think it's important that, you know, the Western thing you mentioned, you know, they were both a little bit nostalgic. Their forms of nostalgia were very different. I mean, for the Dead, it was this kind of old, weird America that Grail Marcus talks about, you know, that they were trying to get in touch with, you know, through their music and through the themes and Robert Hunter's lyrics in particular. You know, for Reagan, it was something quite different. It was Death Valley days and television and cowboys and Indians and stuff like that. And then later, I think that the contrast between the two projects, Reagan's on the one hand, another Californian utopian in some ways, once he gets in the White House, one of the things that he does is he militarizes the war on drugs. Now, this did touch the Grateful Dead community pretty directly, and they didn't like it very much. And I think they felt very beset through the early 1980s, which was a very slack time for the Dead creatively. And then it became perilous even when Jerry Garcia went into a diabetic coma that almost killed him. Then they come back with Touch of Grey in 1987. And that chorus, I will survive, you know, I will get by. And then they switch in the final chorus to we will get by, we will survive. And of course the Deadheads went bananas. That was exactly what they wanted to hear. We're going to survive this. And so there was a lot of reason to celebrate, you know, Garcia's return to health, the survival of the Deadhead community. I mean, in many ways, that song is a kind of anthem to their own survival. And I think the Reagan administration backdrop, the just say no message, the militarization of the drug war, that actually drew, I think, a new generation of fans to the Grateful Dead project.
Well, as we can see, it's not only a cultural history of the Grateful Dead, but I felt it was it is a good opening up for modern California history as well, and good stories told. So thank you for that. And congratulations on the book. I'm talking with Peter Richardson, A Cultural History of the Grateful Dead, No Simple Highway. And before I let you go, I feel like I would like to mention a couple of your other books that our readers might be interested in as well. American Prophet, The Life and Work of Cary McWilliams, who was the longtime editor of The Nation magazine, and A Bomb in Every Issue, How the Short, Unruly Life of Ramparts Magazine Changed America. And you mention and talk about ramparts in this book, but you have a whole book devoted to that. So maybe can you just give us a few minutes on each one of those books, and maybe they were a path here. I don't know.
Actually, in retrospect, it does look kind of like a path. I first became interested in Carrie McWilliams when I was working at a policy shop called the Public Policy Institute of California. I was an editor, and I asked Peter Schrag, who's a longtime Sacramento Bee editorial page editor, you know, what should I read, you know, by way of background for this job? He said, you should read everything by Carrie McWilliams. I had never even heard of Carrie McWilliams. I was in my 40s, you know, I read books and everything, you know. How did I not know about this figure? So for me, that was a form of homage. I really wanted to hold up this man's achievement, which was remarkable, both as an author, almost always about California. He was probably the state's shrewdest observer up through the 1940s and, in the 30s and 40s. And then he became editor of Nation magazine and ushered that magazine through a very difficult time, the 1950s, you know, the McCarthy era and the crackdown on the American left. And you know, he's trying to edit the Nation magazine during that time. And the pressure was intense. So anyway, I have a great deal of admiration for him. And I think he's another guy who's writing very much like Ralph Gleason. I mean, they made it look easy. It's not easy. You know, and I think actually something that they have in common there, both of those writers and the dead, is it was very important for all of them, you know, and I think it's part of California culture to make sure you don't get caught trying too hard. It's hard work, though. And if you can make it look easy, you know, that's a huge accomplishment. And I think all three of them, the band and the two authors did. Gleason, of course, figures in the Ramparts book as well, but really the principal people there were Warren Hinkle, Robert Scheer, and Dougald Sturmer, the designer of the magazine. It was a magazine that started in 1962 as a Catholic literary quarterly and then turned inexorably almost into a political muckraker that did important stories on the CIA, Vietnam, and the Black Panthers, when the mainstream media was really not covering those stories very well at all. And, you know, it took this kind of upstart magazine based in San Francisco, you know, well outside the corridors of power to sort of say, hey, you know, have we considered the idea that maybe the emperor has no clothes here on questions like the CIA and Vietnam in particular? So they had a lot of panache and a lot of flair, and the magazine looked beautiful, And they recruited a lot of readers who were very disappointed when the magazine flamed out, which it did a couple different times, finally in 1975. But the people who worked there went on to start other magazines that are still around. I mentioned Rolling Stone. Both Jan Wenner and Ralph J. Gleason worked at Ramparts and started Rolling Stone. That's still with us and doing award-winning political journalism still, on top of the music coverage and cultural coverage that they do. And another one was Mother Jones. All the people who the original founders of Mother Jones all worked at Ramparts Magazine too. So I felt like I had a little bit of a head start on the Grateful Dead book, just because Ramparts Magazine was really kind of came out of the same sort of cultural milieu. Like the Dead, they started down on the peninsula and then moved up to San Francisco at almost exactly the same time. But they were more oriented, more interested in politics. And it was really Jan Wenner's insight that the music part and the cultural part of what was going on in San Francisco at that time was more important, maybe even, than even the political journalism, which was very, very significant.
Well, thanks so much, and I hope our readers will be led through the Grateful Dead back to those two books.
Thank you, Suzanne. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with Peter Richardson, and his just-released book is No Simple Highway, A Cultural History of the Grateful Dead. On our next broadcast, we'll feature John C. Hamsey on his coming-of-age memoir, Kaufman's Hill. You can catch John on Wednesday, March 4th at 6 in San Francisco at Book Passage in the Ferry Building. A Novel Idea is a production of Lit Radio and KRCB Public Media. We have production assistance from Sean Knight, Wendy Nicholson, and Mary Moore Campagna. Listen to us online and subscribe to our podcasts at krcb.org. We'll go out with a little bit more from the Dead. This is from their Harper College gig in May of 1970. Thanks for listening. I'm Suzanne Lang. It's a Novel Idea.
And I bid you good night. Good night. Good night. Lay down, my dear brothers. Lay down and take your rest. I want you to lay your head upon your Savior's breast. I love you, oh, but Jesus loves you the best. And I bid you good night, good night, good night. And I bid you good night, good night, good night. Walking in Jerusalem just like John. Good night,
I bid you good night.
I remember right well, I remember right well good night.
A good night, a picture good night.
Rotten stuff should comfort me good
night. A picture good night, a picture good night.
A for the other wonderful world, a good night.
A picture good night.
Tell me before the beast of the end in a wood
good night. A picture good night.
Where we meet all the children that would not be good
good night. Picture good night.
I'm walking in Jerusalem just like
John. Good night. Good night.
I'm walking in the city of the shadow of death.
Good night. Picture good night. Picture
good night. Lay down, my dear brothers. Lay down and take your rest. I want you to lay your head upon your Savior's breast. I love you, oh, but Jesus loved you the best.
And
I bid you good night, good night, good night. And I bid you good night, good night, good night. And I bid you good night. Good night, good night.